government regulations, which were created to protect employees, are actually hurting them.
Regulation after regulation.
Until the government understands that they have to create an environment suitable for us to keep growing, we're going to stay in this recession a long time.
The federal government has blocked efforts to expand the ride-sharing.
The owners say the restaurant has succumbed to the crush of government regulation.
We have seen an unprecedented explosion of new regulatory activity.
$1.8 trillion.
That's how much
business and bus companies to close.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be changed. There is red tape that needs to be cut.
The regulations are massive.
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep
it? Is this really the best we can do?
Welcome to Free Lunch, the podcast of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers.
On July 23rd, RTP hosted a teleforum titled Subdelegations of Rulemaking Power and the Appointments Clause. This call featured insights from Todd Gaziano, the Pacific Legal Foundation, Professor Ann Joseph O'Connell from Stanford Law School, and our moderator, Professor Kristen Hickman from the University of Minnesota Law School. Please send us your feedback.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the Federalist Society's Free Lunch Podcast for the Regulatory Transparency Project. My name is William Hild, and I'm the Deputy Director of RTP. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the guest speakers on today's call. We've been looking forward to this afternoon's discussion entitled Subdelegations of Rulemaking Power and the Appointments Clause. Today's teleforum will examine a variety of topics related to the subdelegation of rulemaking power. We are joined today by Todd Gaziano, Chief of Legal Policy and Strategic Research and Director for the Center for the Separation of Powers at the Pacific Legal Foundation, Professor Ann Joseph O'Connell, Edelbert H. Sweet Professor of Law at Stanford Law School, and our moderator, Professor Kristen Hickman, Distinguished McKnight University Professor and Harlan Albert Rogers Professor in Law at the University of Minnesota's Law School. If you would like to learn more about Todd, Ann, or Kristen's work, please visit fedsoc.org, where we've listed their full bios. I will turn it over first to Kristen to get us started. After opening remarks and discussion between our speakers, we will go to audience Q&A. So audience members, please think of what you'd like to ask our speakers. Thank you both for joining us. Kristen, the floor is yours.
Thank you, William. Now, as William said, our topic today is subdelegation, agency-making, and the Appointments Clause. The Supreme Court, as far back as 1976, Valeo identified rulemaking as the sort of government power that characterizes a government official as an officer of the United States who needs to be appointed consistent with the Appointments Clause of Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution, as opposed to being a mere employee. The Buckley Court had no need to evaluate whether the officers at issue in that case were principal or inferior for Appointments Clause purposes. So as a formal matter, whether rulemaking is the province of principal officers alone or inferior ones remains an open question. But many statutes that delegate rulemaking power to principal officers also allow for the subdelegation of that power to lower-level agency officials. And as Todd will describe at greater length, a recent study of rulemaking in the Department of Health and Human Services found that a substantial majority of the regulations issued by that agency were signed by career civil service employees rather than by officers appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. And some of those regulations were quite significant, reflecting the sorts of policy choices that we might prefer to see resolved by political actors rather than by career bureaucrats. Todd will lead off our discussion today by elaborating these points. Todd?
Well, thank you, and thank you to everyone, including both you, Kristen, and to Ann for preparing. And I'll begin by saying that last Wednesday, Senator Rand Paul chaired a congressional subcommittee hearing on this topic, or rulemaking by democratically unaccountable bureaucrats, as we would term it. My colleague Tommy Berry testified, and I'm going to make his 3 points in reverse order, but elaborate on the legal points. And the 3 points are these. First, that rulemaking by employees rather than principal or superior officers of the United States is flatly unconstitutional, and it's not even close. Second, that this unconstitutional practice is rampant, at least at HHS, including 98% of FDA rules. And third, that this rulemaking practice, whether it is legal or not, has weakened the separation of powers and harmed political accountability, and we should demand that it stop, regardless of which branch of government gets the job done first. As for the constitutional issues, the Supreme Court has held, as Kristen said in Buckley versus Vallejo, that the power to issue final rules that bind the public is a significant authority that can only be exercised by officers of the United States appointed in conformity with the Appointments Clause. But as she also said, they didn't pass on what level of officer. The Constitution divides officers of the United States into two general categories, principal and inferior officers. Now, a recent paper by Gary Lawson and Steve Calabresi argue that the principal officer category really is misnamed and should be further subdivided into a single principal officer for each department and superior officers, and that has much going for it, but that further delineation doesn't make much difference in today's discussion, except for a point I'll make in a minute. What we do know is that principal or superior officers are those which must be nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate without exception. Inferior officers must also be presidentially appointed and Senate confirmed unless, as the Constitution provides, Congress by law vests the appointment of inferior officers in certain key principal officers, including department heads. The Supreme Court noted that inferior officers' work is directed and supervised by Senate-confirmed supervisors, but mere supervision isn't enough to render someone an inferior officer, as several justices have pointed out. And if mere supervision renders anyone an inferior officer, that would mean there's only one principal officer in each department. There are no other superior officers. And all ambassadors, all deputy secretaries, all U.S. attorneys, all assistant secretaries would be inferior officers. Indeed, district court judges and court of appeals judges would be inferior officers if mere supervision is enough, since their lower court judges' work is reviewed by Senate-confirmed Supreme Court justices. So what is clear about whether a task can be given to someone who is an inferior officer? Well, for today's discussion, it's particularly relevant to say that presidential nomination and Senate confirmation is constitutionally required for those officers who make final government decisions or take final agency actions. This is a bit of an oversimplification, but this is certainly one of the tests. If that final government action cannot be altered by a superior officer, even if those final decision makers are supervised in some aspects of their job. And so that's why some judges whose rulings cannot be altered by a higher agency, some agency judges, I should say, whose rulings cannot be overruled by a higher officer are generally considered to be principal officers, and rightly so. And other ALJs, such as the SEC ALJs in Lucia, whose decisions are reviewable by the SEC commissioners, are deemed to be inferior officers. So what does that mean for rulemaking? Well, the courts haven't resolved this next point, as Kristen says, but we at the Pacific Legal Foundation are suing to establish, on behalf of 9 small business retailers harmed by an FDA rule, that those who issue final regulations must be superior or principal officers appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate, because no one can undo a rulemaking, not even the president, without another rulemaking. Now, there's possible supervision at the draft rulemaking stage, but that shouldn't matter, since that also is the case with an ambassador's diplomatic efforts or the solicitor general's oral argument preparation. The fact that the attorney general or the secretary of state can supervise ambassadors or the a solicitor general doesn't make them inferior officers. And contrary to what some may hope about the rulemaking process, the FDA in our litigation is not arguing that a particular level of supervision occurred for the deeming rule we're challenging, just that it was theoretically possible that someone could have supervised that career employee who issued the rule. And what is even clearer, because it's a direct result of Buckley versus Vallejo's holding, is that career employees cannot constitutionally issue rules no matter what level of supervision, theoretical or actual, takes place. Now, one hypothetical defense to this practice that I've heard since we've issued our report and begun our litigation is that employee rulemaking, at least the defense of employee rulemaking, is that rules are really issued by the agency that the employee works for or by the principal officers who are in charge, and that their signature on them doesn't really matter or is a mere formality. Well, this is a hypothetical defense for the most part because the Department of Justice doesn't, in fact, raise that defense in our lawsuit, even though the Department of Justice always raises a plethora of silly defenses. In our litigation, DOJ and FDA admit that the longtime career FDA employee, her name is Leslie Cux, issued the rule we challenge. Among their defenses, however, the Department of Justice claimed that Ms. Cux was also an inferior officer when she issued the rule, and that inferior officers can bind the public with such actions. Now, if someone is interested in the question period, I'd be glad to explain why this FDA employee could not possibly have been appointed an inferior officer under the Appointments Clause, including that the HHS secretary was never given authority by statute to appoint her. But I want to focus, at least in my opening remarks, on the broad constitutional theory. Now, if my co-panelists or someone else argued that employee signing rules were okay for functional reasons or because of some level of potential supervision, I would have other responses, but let me just offer one analogy. Article 3 judges can't lawfully authorize their law clerks to write judicial opinions in the law clerks' names, even if those rulings were routine and the judges liked the result. Judges must preside at all trials, no matter how routine, and they must issue every word of every opinion in their own name, even if the law clerks drafted them. So that's my constitutional argument. My next two are very brief. But my second point is that employee rulemaking, and not just so-called inferior officer rulemaking, is rampant. The following numbers come from our Pacific Legal Foundation study co-authored by Angela C. Erickson and Tommy Berry. They collected all final rules issued in the Department of Health and Human Services going back to 2001, and this is their result. 71% of those rules were issued by persons who had never been confirmed by the Senate, and the overwhelming majority of those were by employees rather than anyone who was arguably an inferior officer. That's nearly 2,100 rules, and within FDA, 98% of their rules, or 1,860 rules, were issued by employees. As Kristen indicated, this is not limited just to minor rules or typo fixes. Our study found that 1,300 substantive rules were signed by non-Senate confirmed employees, and most of those were employees. And of those deemed significant by the Office of Management and Budget, 34% were signed by non-Senate confirmed folks to the tune of billions of dollars. So in just one department, we had thousands of rules issued and continue to be issued by career employees with no direct accountability to the Senate of the people. Now, my final point is that this subverts democratic accountability even if it were constitutional. Congress and the president should ban it even before the courts rule on our lawsuit. Robert Califf, for example, was asked a series of questions in his confirmation hearing to be FDA commissioner in 2015 about potential rulemaking choices he might make. Yet the vast majority of rules during his tenure were not made by him, but by a career FDA employee, never nominated by the president or confirmed by the Senate. That employee was hired before Califf and continued after Califf left. We have no idea how much supervision Califf provided on each of these rules, but we do know that he didn't want his name on hundreds of them. In such a system, the decisions the Senate makes to confirm or reject nominees may not bear much on the judgment of those actually issuing the rules. Similarly, the president has never nominated or is expected to possibly even know the names of these bureaucrats. And that doesn't matter if they don't issue final rules. But when rulemaking decisions are made by low-level employees, the public is deprived of the ability to trace any blame to the top, and it deprives those rules of democratic accountability. Finally, our study of HHS rulemaking was quite interesting in that it found that every single substantive rule issued by the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services was not only signed by a Senate-confirmed appointee, but often by two. It was often countersigned by the HHS secretary. So this proves that there's no impediment to constitutional rulemaking. And so we should, without exception, insist that all rulemaking be done in this manner. So thanks. Back to you, Kristen.
Thank you, Todd. Before I turn the discussion over to Ann, let me ask you just a couple of questions. One, just a clarification point to make sure that I'm following your argument correctly. So you pointed out that under the Appointments Clause, inferior officers are appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate unless by law Congress establishes that they will be appointed by the president alone, by the head of a department, or by a court of law. So what are you saying, that inferior officers can sign regulations if they are appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate, but that inferior officers who are not PAS appointees could not sign regulations?
Very interesting question, and the courts haven't actually clarified one point that I think is necessary to answer it. And that is, anyone who is actually Senate confirmed, they just assume as a principal officer. So yes, you're right, the Constitution requires that even inferior officers follow the default procedure of presidential appointment, Senate confirmation. But maybe Ann knows of a case, but I can't think of a case where the courts have said the Senate-confirmed person is an inferior officer. And at least, you know, we who are trying to establish a constitutional process for rulemaking wouldn't be trying to litigate that particular instance, as long as we have bigger, you know, lower-hanging fruit, bigger fish to fry, where we clearly have rulemaking done by career employees who are not remotely inferior officers, and by some inferior officers who are appointed by a department head. In both of those situations, it seems like a much clearer case that there is a lack of direct political accountability to the president and to the Senate.
Okay. So I guess the next question I have is a more pragmatic one. If courts believe that political appointees, people who are appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate, are aware of and approve of at least most, if not all, of the regulations that an agency issues, and certainly the most significant ones, do you think the courts are likely to invalidate 2/3 of HHS regulations, including 98% of FDA regulations, simply because of the name and the signature block?
First of all, the courts only act on a case-by-case basis. So they're in the lawsuit we have against FDA, I think recognizing the weakness of their position, they had Commissioner Gottlieb attempt to ratify the rule right before he left. And so there may be a lot of fixes. We challenge the effectiveness of that ratification under the APA because of a lot of substantive things that occurred, scientific development since the illegal rule was first issued in the ratification. But many other rules, the courts have authorized ratification. So, I mean, on a case-by-case basis, the courts will have to sort out what to do with unconstitutional rules. And some of them make, in our study, truly were minor and typo fixes. We talked about some of the significant ones. There may not be anyone withstanding. It may not matter. But as far as whether the Supreme Court has the will to enforce the Constitution, that's always a question. But in Chadha, there were 160 statutes that were eventually held to be unconstitutional. So once this, you know, before 1976, Buckley versus Leo is really the return of the Supreme Court taking the structural provisions of the Constitution seriously. Before that, there were a few decades where almost anything went. But since Buckley versus Vallejo, that's not been the case. And I think Chadha is the best example of them doing the right thing and letting the chips fall where they may.
Well, thank you for that. Why don't we turn it now over to Anne, whose views will no doubt reflect her extensive scholarship on both the topics of rulemaking and issues associated with the staffing of government agencies. Anne?
Thank you, Kristen. Thank you, Todd. So as I understand the basic constitutional argument, it goes as follows, that Health and Human Services and the Food and Drug Administration within it have delegated authority to issue rules to senior careerists at the agency, and they've issued thousands of these rules, some portion of which are economically significant. But the argument goes that only officers can issue such rules, and indeed likely only principal officers can do so. And the argument continues that senior careerists are not officers. They're definitely not principal officers because they're not appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate, but they're also not inferior officers, as was suggested at the start, because of appointment issues, but in the Senate testimony last week, also because of removal restrictions, that you can fire someone from the senior executive service only for cause. So I want to go through that argument and present various challenges to it, and then conclude with some points of agreement that I have. So let me take first the idea of agency delegations. And there was an empirical claim in the Senate testimony last week that Congress is not aware of the many sub-delegations. And I'm not sure that's right. So in the 1998 Vacancies Act itself, Congress explicitly references sub-delegations, kind of preventing agencies from changing them within 180 days of a vacancy in a Senate-confirmed position. Many of these delegations are published in the Federal Register. And indeed, Congress itself has permitted the delegations in the first place. So the Social Security Administration statute says, quote, the commissioner may assign duties and delegate or authorize successive redelegations of authority to act and to render decisions to such officers and employees of the administration as the commissioner may find necessary. And when courts have looked at these delegation clauses in typically in agency organic statutes, they often presume that the subdelegation is permissible. So the D.C. Circuit in 2004 said, you know, quote, absent affirmative evidence of a contrary congressional intent. So to the appointments clause issue, so turning to the claim that only officers can issue rules, I also am not sure that's right. So Professor Ron Levin at Washington University in St. Louis recently pointed out that the majority in Kaiser this term at the Supreme Court in discussing our deference talked about authoritative action within the agency. So the majority says the regulatory interpretation must be one actually made by the agency. In other words, it must be the agency's authoritative or official position rather than an ad hoc statement not reflecting the agency's views. Of course, the requirement of authoritative action, the court said, must recognize a reality of bureaucratic life. Not everything the agency does comes from or is even in the name of the secretary or its chief advisors. So, for example, the court continued, we have deferred to official staff memoranda that were published in the Federal Register, even though in this never approved by the agency head. But there are limits, the majority went on. The interpretation must at least emanate from those actors using those vehicles understood to make authoritative policy in the relative context. So that's the quote from Kaiser. Now, most critically, the senior careerists are not operating in isolation. So although formally they're signing the rule, the head of the Food and Drug Administration, the head of HHS, are signing off on major rules and even minor rules. OIRA, the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, and the Executive Office of the President is signing off both on the proposed and final rule if the rule is major. And so I do worry some that the sort of fixation on the agency signature belies the reality of agency rulemaking. But let's take for granted that only officers can sign off on rulemaking. I think there's an argument, as DOJ has made, that these senior careerists are inferior officers chosen by the head of the department as permitted by congressional delegation. And here I'll just flag, it's interesting to see that there are the challenges coming from the Pacific Legal Foundation against these Food and Drug Administration rulemakings, but we're also seeing challenges kind of from the other side. William Funk has a draft on SSRN about the Environmental Appeals Board, so there are kind of challenges to this inferior officer idea, but this is how it goes. So in Edmund versus the United States, which is a case that those of us who teach is the primary case for talking about the distinction between principal and inferior officers, in that case itself, that involved an appointment that was permitted only by a general delegation to the Secretary of Transportation. So the congressional delegation to the Secretary of Transportation said, quote, "The Secretary of Transportation may appoint and fix the pay of officers and employees of the Department of Transportation and may prescribe their duties and powers." And so it was, in fact, the kind of judges of the Coast Guard Court of Criminal Appeals and the Department of Transportation, those positions were actually kind of created under that general language, which is sometimes referred to as accepting clauses in the statute. And there have been some court cases, other court cases at the Court of Appeals level that have upheld this inferior officer idea. So the Department of Labor has a similar governing statute. It says the secretary, quote, "from time to time, makes such provisions as he shall deem appropriate, authorizing the performance by any other officer or by any agency or employee of the Department of Labor of any function of the secretary." So the Fifth Circuit, in a case called Willie versus the Administrative Review Board, interpreted this language to permit the Secretary of Labor to create an Administrative Review Board, appoint members to the board, and delegate decision-making authority to them. So then the question is, can these senior executive service officials qualify as inferior officers? So we can leave to the Q&A about whether kind of through the chain of delegation they've been appointed properly by the head of the department. But there was an argument made in the Senate testimony last week about the removal aspect, that they can't be inferior officers because they can be fired only for cause from their jobs. And that would mean they don't kind of have the requisite supervision. And I think that's based on a kind of mistaken understanding about how the senior executive service operates. So it's true that you can't be fired from the SES kind of on the whole without cause, but you can be moved around pretty easily within the senior executive service, right? Indeed, a portion of the senior executive service jobs are political appointments, not career appointments, no more than 25% in any agency, and you can kind of shift the pieces on the chessboard. And you could also think about the D.C. Circuit's recent ruling with regard to Special Counselor Mueller, saying he was an inferior officer despite Department of Justice regulations that he could be fired only for cause, the idea being that the Department of Justice could change those regulations without prior notice and comment. And so in this kind of same sense, you can move the SES person out of a particular position and just move them into a different kind of SES position. Now, this only works if you allow inferior officers to do the rulemakings. And so what about the argument that's advanced that only principal officers can sign off on rules? And to some extent, I think we may just have to kind of agree to disagree or talk past each other. So there was discussion in the Senate testimony in the earlier report about the framers and the administrative state, and Jennifer Mascott's really provocative and interesting work about the appointments clause. But modern rulemaking really dates only from the 1970s after the Supreme Court's decision in Florida East Coast Railway. So if we're sort of bound by historical practice at the time of the founding, right, much of modern administrative practice would be struck down. Now, what I would say about the finality point, as a functionalist, right? I'm not the formalist on the call, but as a functionalist, I do think that these rules are only getting signed off once they've been approved by the higher ups, and they can be undone by those above them. And I could just raise a policy concern. So in the Senate testimony last week by Thomas Berry, he claimed that most actings were Senate confirmed, because you might worry as a matter of policy in times of presidential transitions, are you going to have someone Senate confirmed at the agency to be able to sign off on these rules? But at the start of President Trump's administration in 2017, there were 13 acting secretaries across the 15 departments on January 20th, and only four of the 13 were Senate confirmed under President Obama. Right, the other nine were actually basically senior careerists at the agencies, and some of those non-confirmed folks stayed for weeks and even months. Right, so weeks at Treasury and months at the Department of Agriculture. But let me conclude with this: some points of agreement is that I think I would prefer, all else being equal, that major rules be issued by political appointees for the reasons that were discussed at the start, and primarily a kind of accountability rationale. And I would also note, because I'm not just obsessed with the Appointments Clause, I'm also very interested in vacancies and the Vacancies Act, is that the arguments that I just kind of ran through do give me some pause when I think about my own arguments, when I think about a different context. And that's what agencies do in the face of Senate-confirmed vacancies. So last month, after Senate Republicans made clear that they were not going to confirm Ken Cuccinelli to a top Department of Homeland Security post, the White House had the acting DHS secretary create a new position in U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, that of a principal deputy director, to which Cuccinelli was named. And then that position then arguably allowed him under the Vacancies Act to be named as acting director of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services without being Senate confirmed. And, of course, he's now wielding considerable authority and can do so until the end of this calendar year without a pending nomination of someone else to do the job. And we saw then Secretary of the Interior Zinke also created a number of deputy positions and delegated functions of Senate confirmed jobs to these new deputies who never faced Senate approval. So you can think about the questions that are raised in the rulemaking context, in this context as well, right? Are Cuccinelli and these deputies at the Department of Interior, are they proper inferior officers, right? They were also kind of done by, through these accepting clauses, allowing the head of the agency to sub-delegate down. So these are tricky questions, not just in the rulemaking context, but also in the vacancy context. And so I look forward to the discussion.
Thanks, Anne. I'm a little bit curious here. You know, do you know of any court that has ever held that an SES official is an officer of the United States? I was trying to think of one, and I couldn't.
No, because if you look at these cases, I'm not sure. I should go. There's a handful of these cases at the courts of appeal that involve these accepting clauses, and I don't think they... You know, was the Administrative Review Board in the Department of Labor case or the Environmental Appeals Board at the EPA? It is and there's been no court case on that. Mm-hmm. It is conceivable to me that some of those are SES positions.
Because it does strike me, you know, I suppose this is just impressionistic on my part, but I suppose in my own mind I have always divided officers of the United States, whether they're principal or inferior, versus mere employees, at least in part by thinking of political appointees versus career. Maybe that's not the right way of thinking about it, but at a certain symbolic level at least, and I think symbolism is important when it comes to separation of powers principles, when you think about who's doing the policy making, who's making the big decisions, that we like to think at least that it is the government officials who are accountable to the political process. If not the Congress and the president directly, then at least political appointees who have been appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate, who answer to the president, that those are the people who are making those big decisions, rather than career employees who aren't so accountable to the political process. You know, so I wonder, you know, you seem at least sympathetic to the idea that as a matter of practice, if not as a matter of constitutional law, that perhaps, you know, we shouldn't have career officials signing regulations. I guess I wonder your thoughts about, given the skepticism that large segments of the public feel about the unaccountability of career agency officials, whether public participation, public perceptions regarding the political legitimacy of agency regulations wouldn't be enhanced if we simply, as a matter of constitutional law, required officers who had been appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate to sign those regulations.
So let me just take a kind of assumption you made at the start. I think that the dividing line between kind of who's political and whose career is not as stark as one might think. I mean, in the senior executive service itself, up to 10% of the SES slots are political slots, and in a particular agency, up to 25% of the SES slots can be political. So even kind of what we think of as kind of senior careerists in the SES has a kind of political dimension. And then just in terms of the realities of modern government, so also in the Vacancies Act, the third category of allowing people to step in temporarily to Senate-confirmed jobs in cabinet departments and executive agencies says that if you're a senior agency worker who's been at the agency at least 90 days in the past year prior to the vacancy and you're paid at GS-15 or higher, that category takes both a kind of senior careerist like Adam Zubin, who was acting Secretary of the Treasury at the start of President Trump's administration, but also Matthew Whitaker, who was acting Attorney General after Jeff Sessions stepped down. With regard to public perceptions, of course, kind of the image, the kind of visual of it, kind of always better to have Senate-confirmed people. I just think the reality of the appointments process, and it's not just this administration where you do see even greater kind of holes in Senate-confirmed positions, given that the Senate is also controlled by the same party that controls the White House. But also in the Obama administration, you have kind of vast vacancies, right? So in some of the empirical work I've done, kind of on average, a quarter of the time, these Senate-confirmed positions are not staffed by someone who's been Senate-confirmed. And so what do you do with that, kind of in the realities of modern governance? But sure, so you said as a matter of constitutional law, I guess I would say as a matter of policy, right, always better to have Senate-confirmed officials. I just don't think that it's constitutionally compelled.
So, Todd, I want to give you a chance to respond to Anne.
Before we do that, Kristen, would you mind if I just hop in real quick so that we can open up the Q&A queue?
By all means.
Excellent. So, audience, in a moment you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to the request the floor, enter star, then pound.
So, Todd, do you want to respond to some of Anne's points?
And when we get to your request, you'll hear a prompt, and then please state your name and affiliation, and then ask your question, and we will be answering questions in the order in which they received. Sorry to jump in there, Todd. I'll hand it back to you.
Sure. Thank you very much, both Kristen and Anne. And Anne always brings a lot of powerful knowledge to bear, but let me try to clarify a few points directly in response to hers. Anne is certainly right. She's much more of an expert on sub-delegations generally, but we've got to distinguish the type of delegations and the type of statutes that allow those. You know, most delegations of internal agency procedure don't really matter, don't really affect third parties, or many of them don't. But there's a difference with rulemaking, which is lawmaking. And there's also a difference between what one district court has called housekeeping statutes and housekeeping statutes and housemaking statutes. So a statute that says that a secretary can, you know, reassign functions and duties is not problematic at all, even though it allows some level of delegations. But then there are constitutional applications. So there, if it is a duty that must be exercised by a Senate-confirmed principal officer, then the cabinet secretary can use those housekeeping functions to reassign to one Senate-confirmed officer who's under another Supreme Court case called Weiss and its progeny. If it's germane to their original duty, they can exercise some function. For example, U.S. attorneys in one district can help U.S. attorneys in another district, or so on and so forth. But there's a huge difference between the actual power to appoint inferior officers. And there the Supreme Court has said there has to be two requirements. The Congress by law has to authorize the appointment of an officer, and that's not just a housekeeping official, and then vested in the secretary. And that relates to another point that Anne made. She pointed out correctly, of course, that in Edmund, the Supreme Court interpreted a transportation statute as granting the transportation secretary the authority to appoint inferior officers. Rightly so, because that's what that statute allowed. But that isn't the case, and a few lower courts have been confused about this and have gotten most of these right, but a few wrong. But the HHS secretary doesn't have such authority. Lawson and Calabresi argue that the attorney general doesn't either, and that the D.C. Circuit was mistaken in this regard. I'll defer to them on the attorney general. But with regard to the HHS secretary, Congress only granted authority to appoint inferior officers in certain divisions. Now, that is very powerful evidence that Congress didn't give the HHS secretary a general authority to appoint inferior officers throughout the department, or the specific authority would be surplusage. The fact remains that, you know, that Anne is right that Congress can grant inferior officer the power, can authorize department heads to appoint inferior officers, but they have not done so in the HHS case. And that relates to my third point I wanted to respond to. Anne looked at the third reason we gave, and maybe the hardest and least important reason why the career SES officer who issued the deeming rule, why we think couldn't be an inferior officer, and that had to do with the tenure protection that a career SES officer has. But that's the weakest of arguments. The two stronger arguments we have why she can't even possibly be an inferior officer, and this may be true in a lot of other departments, not in the Department of Transportation, for example, but in the Department of Health and Human Services, Congress never by law authorized the creation of the office that this rulemaker occupied. The office is the Associate Commissioner for Policy. Congress never by law authorized the creation of that office, and Congress never by law gave HHS Secretary the power to appoint such an official. And then the second reason is the HHS Secretary never did appoint the official, Ms. Cox, who made the rule. She was selected from the SES ranks by the Commissioner of FDA, and the Commissioner of FDA is not a department head. So, you know, without going to our weakest argument, I don't concede it. These other reasons are much, much stronger for saying that the FDA rulemaking, and by the way, there's a written delegation. There's a written delegation. The original one was from 1991, and it's been updated. But there's a written delegation that the occupant of this, you know, career SES position has concurrent rulemaking power. This was not inadvertent. This was not accidental. It's just unconstitutional. And then the last two points I want to hit is that, and you know, correctly notes that there's a certain level of supervision of major rules higher up in most agencies, sometimes even through OIRA, but that isn't the kind of direct accountability that the framers had in mind. And throughout the framing debates, the Constitutional Convention, the framers rejected a Privy Council and a Council of Revision, all because they didn't want to diffuse accountability in the executive branch. And then they created this Appointments Clause. And the Appointments Clause premise is that certain officials need to be appointed by the President, confirmed by the Senate, regardless of what some future Congress might say. And that purpose would be wholly defeated if all that mattered were that one official in every department be Senate confirmed, and then everything could be delegated by that person at whatever level is possible. So we have a constitution that limits the diffusion of responsibility, I think for very good reasons, and the debates on the opinions clause and the debates on unitary executive reinforce the point that the appointments clause has real limits. And my final point, and it's really one of agreement with Anne, she has probably studied the number of officials. I'm kind of shocked that only 4 of 13 acting officials were Senate confirmed. And what that shows is a major failure of the of one or both of the outgoing Obama administration or the Trump administration during the transition. And that needs to be fixed. When I was at the Office of Legal Counsel, we certainly approved or tried to approve which, you know, people could assume vacancy positions. But certainly during a transition, we strongly advised of the necessity for someone who was Senate confirmed to be the caretaker until the next administration had someone confirmed. It's easy to do. It's easy for any agency to issue rules in a constitutional way. You just have, because the most of rulemaking authority is delegated initially to the cabinet secretary and then sub-delegated down. If there's always a constitutional acting secretary, there will always be someone to constitutionally issue rules. And I will join with Anne and with others in ensuring that we always do have Senate-confirmed officials, at least one in every department who is acting for the department as the acting secretary. And with that, I welcome questions, or first I would suggest further comments from Anne if she wants to try to correct anything that I've said.
No, I'm happy to move on to the Q&A given the time constraints.
Great. Well, we do have one question, so I'm going to open up the line to that participant.
Good afternoon. This is Warren Belmar speaking. I thought the discussions have been truly outstanding, and you've covered so many important issues. I raised one question, though. Has anyone studied the subdelegation of agency enforcement actions? You've had the same thing happening with rulemaking and with enforcement, where career officials have been charged with conducting the proceedings within the agency, which could lead to either a final agency order or the need for judicial review of a challenged decision by the agency. And given the statutes in place with respect to the size of the penalties that the agencies can impose, for example, at the Department of Energy, by statute, certain violations are $100 maximum per violation, but the statute allows for that to have been increased by taking into account inflation, and so now it's up to $440 per violation. And to the extent that that kind of enforcement authority is delegated down to career officials that are unaccountable, it becomes quite problematic, just as is the case with respect to the rulemaking delegation.
So I would like, let me ask a clarifying question. When you ask about enforcement actions, I mean, the scenarios with which I'm familiar all anticipate that it's either going to be an ALJ or the agency or someone who's making the – someone who is appointed consistent with the Appointments Clause who's going to make the ultimate determination about whether penalties should be assessed. When you, are you talking about the people who are carrying out the prosecutorial function and whether they ought to be officers of the United States or whether that's a subdelegation?
A lot of instances, and I see that at the Department of Energy right now, it is not an ALJ who makes the final enforcement decision. In fact, in some areas, it's the general counsel who also is charged with appointing the or subdelegating. So to assume that everything is done through ALJs or independent decision makers on enforcement decisions is not correct. And I'm sure it varies throughout the government, just as the subdelegation provisions for rulemaking vary from agency to agency.
I guess
I'm just suggesting it as a fruitful area of further inquiry because the concepts are the same and the delegation to non-accountable career officials for very significant enforcement penalty assertions start creating problems, especially when those lower agency officials can issue a press release that they're suing a small company for umpteen million dollars. That sort of hampers the ability of anyone to defend themselves, depending on the nature of the power being exercised.
Let me try to jump in and give a general answer. Certainly, lower-level agency officials can harm corporations, and you know our clients face that all the time. As far as some officers who make jurisdictional determinations or fail to make them in the Army Corps, but I think the constitutional cause of action would only accrue, or even, you know, a statutory APA, once there's final agency action. And so I think that the same principles could apply to enforce or should apply to enforcement actions, but only at the final agency action stage. So yes, it's unfortunate, and you know, maybe lower level officials should be more careful in how they act as well. I think your question is really triggered at, you know, under Bennett v. Sears test for finality.
That would be my assessment as well.
If I could just jump in just on the descriptive or empirical question, I think we know very little about subdelegations in agencies. I mean, what is so interesting to me about the report by Erickson in Barry is that I didn't know the extent to which rules were issued by non-Senate confirmed officials. I mean, I disagree on the legal components, but just the descriptive empirical information about agency practices is incredibly helpful to have. I mean, Jennifer Noh at the University of Chicago has written kind of, I would argue, kind of the most in-depth treatment of some of the legal questions regarding subdelegation, has some examples, but is not kind of an in-depth empirical treatment. She has joined kind of forces, as I understand, with Brian Feinstein at the Wharton School to do more research. I don't know how much of that will be on enforcement actions versus rulemaking. And then I can say I'm a public member of the Administrative Conference of the United States and am a project consultant for an ongoing research initiative on acting officials and delegated authority. And as part of that report, I've gathered some information about subdelegations in the face of vacancies in Senate-confirmed positions. But there's kind of much more to be learned.
William, do we have any other questions from callers?
We
listeners?
Do not have anyone in the queue at the moment. So if anyone has any, you know, we've got about 6 minutes left. So if the speakers
let me
have
follow
any
on
left.
What Kristen just said and pose another question to Anne, which is that I think in one of your remarks you said that that rules can be undone, but I think what you meant is before they're issued in their final form. Once they're issued in their final form, there are very few exceptions to undoing them other than another rulemaking, wouldn't you agree?
Yes, yes. I didn't mean to suggest that because they were issued by a senior careerist that the agency head, there was some special exception in the Administrative Procedure Act to skip that.
Sure. Well, then I think we would, and I thought that's what you meant.
Yes.
But then we would agree that all rulemaking is final agency action. Of course, under the APA, it's all it's well established. It's final agency action. And so, you know, that's I think the main argument we have for why, you know, given the distinction the courts have applied to different types of agency judges, and all agency judges have some supervision in how they perform their duties. But what the Supreme Court looks at between which ones need to be principal officers and which ones need to be inferior officers is which isn't wholly determined on this, but it seems to significantly turn on whether their final decisions are can be overturned by a higher agency official. In that regard, it's why we argue that rulemaking has to be done by a principal officer.
Yeah, Todd, right after I said we didn't have any questions, somebody joined the question queue. So, caller, if you can make it brief, we've got time for your question before we close up here.
You seem to be talking about agencies that corporations have to deal with that are unreasonable, but we all have to deal with the IRS. And their determinations can be horrendous to individuals. And I just wonder how this fits in with the IRS.
Well, so, you know, I will say with respect to the IRS that Treasury and the IRS have their own issues when it comes to compliance with the Administrative Procedure Act, let alone the Constitution. However, I mean, I will say that although, in my experience, although IRS participates in the drafting of Treasury regulations, that it's typically the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury who signs them. Now, you know, this gets back to my original point, is the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury, he or she is appointed by the president with advice and consent of the Senate, but are they principal or inferior? And I'm not sure that we have a clear answer to that question, and I think it may be relevant. But the other issue being, of course, sub-regulatory IRS guidance that is not, you know, revenue rulings, revenue procedures, notices that are not signed off by the Assistant Secretary. The Assistant Secretary might review them, but might not review them very closely at least, and doesn't sign them. And there's I think that there's an open question about whether and to what extent those sub-regulatory guidance documents really ought to be recharacterized as legislative rules and ought to be taken more seriously, because you can be penalized for not complying with them under the penalty regulations that IRS has adopted, defining what's a rule or regulation for penalty purposes. So the IRS is a very, very complicated case where the jury is still sort of out, as it were, because we're still litigating these issues since the Supreme Court's decision in the Mayo case in 2011.
If I could jump in sort of beyond the IRS, as sort of as I indicated in quoting from the Kaiser decision, so much of the functioning of modern government, a lot of it is authoritative, as the majority wrote in Kaiser, these official staff memoranda and the like, where you're not getting sign-off by the agency head. And the courts have given deference, at least five justices would give kind of deference to those, even separate from the deference questions, would treat them kind of as authoritative agency action. Now, of course, rulemaking is very law-like. I mean, I tell students that, you know, agencies do more lawmaking than Congress, if you think about kind of major rules and other rulemaking compared to, say, statutes. And so that's why kind of earlier I kind of pushed hard on this kind of inferior officer argument.
I think it is important, though, to recognize when you're talking about the kind of official and authoritative guidance that the court was talking about in Kaiser, that they weren't suggesting that those kinds of guidance documents carry the force and effect of law.
That,
You know, interpretive rules and policy statements under the APA fall under the general guise of rulemaking, but they lack legal force, and the court's been pretty clear in multiple cases in making that distinction. Now, they may merit some degree of deference under the court's current jurisprudence, but they are looked on, I think, with a less deferential eye than you see with respect to, you know, the notice and comment regulations that do carry legal force.
Thank you for making that point. I was going to, you reminded me that was one of the reasons I wouldn't read too much into the offhand statement in Kisor. I don't think the Supreme Court in that offhand comment would have overruled Buckley, but the example they used in Kisor was staff manuals. There's two other ways of reading it. One is what you just said, Kristen, that there's a difference between substantive rules and giving weight or deference to interpretive rules. The other is that it's a rather opaque statement in Kisor because they said that the department head doesn't need to sign off, but it needs to be authoritative. Does that mean some other principal officer needs to sign off? In all respects, I certainly don't think that overrules Buckley versus Vallejo, that substantive rules, the actual creation of substantive rules that are binding, need not be by an officer.
In both the Allina Health case and I'm blanking on which other one, there is a second case this term in which the court made, you know, talks about distinctions between legislative rules on the one hand and interpretive rules or policy statements on the other. Who has to sign them is a completely different question. I don't think we know what makes something authoritative or official.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Free Lunch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.